The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. On this week's program, we're looking at two of the big issues on the web, privacy and net neutrality. We hear from Desiree Milosevic about who's doing what to keep the information we access on the web free from any one group's control, and we dig deeper into the controversy surrounding RIM's run-ins with the governments around the world over their BlackBerries, and what geotagging in Facebook actually means for the future of data protection. Joining me to debate the details are Charles Arthur, Guardian Technology Editor, and The Guardian's Rick Ray. Welcome to the studio. How are you both?
Very good, thank you.
Well, we'll also be hearing the latest on the British computer games industry from Keith Stewart, who looks after The Guardian's games coverage. He'll tell us what the closure of Real-Time Worlds in Dundee means for the UK games developers. All this, plus the best debate about the technology news that's ricocheting around the web. Keep listening for 30 minutes of Tech Weekly. Here's this week's news. Facebook officially launched Places, their new geolocation tagging service. The technology will allow account holders to check into real-world places using the social network's mobile phone application so their friends can see where they've been, whether it's at the library or at the pub. This follows a year of intense attention on geolocation apps like Foursquare and Gowalla. Places takes this model and brings it to the Facebook masses. But it also opens up enormous debate about the consequences of the content that people freely put online. Last week, for example, Google CEO Eric Schmidt commented that people will want to start their online lives over in the future, wiping their virtual slates clean with new identities, not sullied by years of indiscretions distributed over social networks like Facebook. Now, with the anticipated popularity of Places, people are beginning to move beyond concern with their reputations and are starting to get concerned about their personal safety, as information about where they are at any time is distributed to the online massive. Charles, tell me a little bit more about Places.
Well, it's very much as you've described. The point that Facebook makes about it is that it's opt-in, and at the moment it's in the US only, although people who have a US account can do check-ins in the UK or in other countries. So, for example, there were some which were created around the middle of June when Mark Zuckerberg was over here. Clearly, Facebook Places, they're clearly created around that time. Some people wondered if it might have been him. The fact that it's opt-in, Facebook is saying, is because they're being very cognizant of all the privacy implications. But those check-ins are then visible to your friends, and it's rather hard in the Facebook way to be sure that people don't redistribute those in some way or another. There is a sort of potential for these things to sort of have a chain reaction, in effect, I think. It remains a bit untried, and until we really see it being used, and until we start to see how it can be used and abused, Places is one of those things where you think, interesting idea, but still a bit unclear whether it should have been let out of the laboratory.
Well, you also say that it's shared with friends, but this idea of friends is it's quite a mushy concept on a social network like Facebook. That could be friends and acquaintances, or it could be, you know, people who are friends of friends of friends of friends of friends. So yeah, that's where we start to get into
friend,
a lot of
friend on Facebook doesn't mean the same as friend in real life, does
not
it?
Not necessarily,
it's a
no.
rather different thing.
Well, Rick, what have we already learned about mobile privacy issues associated with geolocation apps like Gowalla and Foursquare? Because this is primarily for the mobile phone users of Facebook.
Yes, I mean, geolocation is obviously the new area for mobile, because you do have these devices which can not only pinpoint you exactly with GPS, but get a vague idea of where you roughly are, either by asking you specifically to tell the system, or by using the towers to locate you. What we've learned so far is, for God's sake, pay attention to privacy settings on these things. Yes, your mobile phone will be keeping a certain amount of information about you, which you can then share with other people, but it's up to you to actually control that. And actually, one thing I wanted to ask about, specifically about Facebook Places, of Charles, was here now is one bit where you can check into somewhere and then you can see other people who've checked in there. And then there's a bit of debate about whether, just because someone has checked in, you will then be sharing your information. In fact, you have been there with someone who isn't your friend, isn't even on your network. It's just someone who happens to go into the same place as you. So there's already some slightly odd and amorphous areas of Facebook Places.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting phenomenon, the idea of using the mobile phone technology to check in somewhere. You know, in many ways, it's saying, okay, well, the web is an interesting place to gather, to meet, to, you know, to extend your offline social interactions. But ultimately, what we're trying to do is we're trying to make sure that people are interacting offline as well. It's kind of, I suppose, in some ways, it's trying to introduce serendipity into the whole process, isn't it?
I mean, I suppose there's on one side, you've got this desire of people to actually meet up, which as soon as social networks got started, we were talking about people meeting in the offline world. And then on the other side, of course, once you know where someone is, especially if they're in a shop or a shopping mall or a shopping centre, you can start bombarding them with adverts and vouchers and Lord knows what else. And it's those two competing desires, which I think, you know, on one part it's people actually wanting to meet up with people, on the other half it's a lot of companies wanting to get in front of these people.
So have we experienced any explosions about privacy because we've been using Foursquare and Gowalla for, what, about a year now?
Yeah, yes, no, certainly. I mean, a lot of people have discovered they were sharing things that perhaps they shouldn't have been sharing. And there were a couple of anecdotal stories in the US about people being found out for being places where they weren't supposed to be or potentially having affairs. I mean, all these stories seem to knock around on the web about people being burgled because they've said they're on holiday on Facebook. So you do have to be very careful about what you say online, and the same thing with geolocation. The other thing I wanted to do just briefly, and this will fall foul terribly of the censors, but I highly recommend anyone who's interested in Foursquare and Gowalla and the rest of these social networking phenomena to go and look at The Onion, a fantastic comedy website, and specifically look up Foursquare, because there's a large, fantastic sort of useful news story on there, which includes the great phrase, launched last year, Foursquare is unique in that it not only allows users to broadcast their whereabouts, but also offers a number of built-in incentives, including some innovative new crap the New York Times surely has a throbbing hard-on for.
That article, I know exactly the one that you're talking about. I had tears running down my face reading it. It's a great commentary on social media technology journalism. Yes. I have to say, I think my favorite Foursquare gaffe came from a friend of mine on Twitter, saying there seemed to be somebody checked in on Foursquare in my house, yet I am not there, and he was a little bit confused about that. So that did sort of spread. Charles, how do you think that what we've experienced with these types of geolocation experiences will affect how people might use places, or do you think that they're even aware of some of these issues?
I think a lot of people aren't aware of it, and it has to be sort of put right up in front of your face before you really start to see it. But I suspect that, you know, tabloids will latch onto this, and that you'll get a lot of big scary stories about this, and people will suddenly start finding ways to turn off the GPS facilities on their phones when they are considering checking in. And I think that people will stand back from it a little more. I mean, possibly in the US it's not going to be so much, because the press over there is slightly different, the way that the media covers these things. But over here, the concentration, just as much as anything, because we're a more crowded island, I think will mean that people are just going to be a lot more concerned about it. There's a website called iCanStalkYou.com, which picks up on the geolocation stuff that people put out. It even points to sites like TwitPic and says, well, actually, there's often geodata tagged in the metadata of the pictures. So if you find a way to pull the pictures down, you can often actually work out where the pictures are taken and, in a roundabout way, you can do these. You know, when Google launched them, people didn't realize how the amount of information that you give out about yourself simply through the searches you put into Google, that it tells a story about what you're thinking about. In the same way, I think that geotagging and things like places, we haven't yet realized what the extent of it is, and there's going to be a whole lot of adjustment to it.
Well, it is ironic, of course, given that Google is an oracle of intentions, that Eric Schmidt suggested that we will in the future want to change our identities. Do you think that the deed polls will be inundated in 10 years' time, Charles, with people wanting to change their names so that their online lives and reputations will be moot and they can start from scratch?
John Gruber, who writes the Daring Fireball site, had an interesting post over the weekend, which was about Eric Schmidt. And he said, the thing about Eric Schmidt is he's just really creepy. And it sort of crystallized a few thoughts, I think, which is that, you know, Eric Schmidt does say things where you think, did you really say that? Are you seriously saying that? I don't think that anyone's really going to want to sort of strip off their teenage years in this way and sort of emerge out of the sort of chrysalis, because you know, who you are is who you are. You don't, changing your name doesn't change your identity. And
how? You obviously had a really boring time in your teenage years, because some of the stuff I got up to as a teenager, I don't want that known by anyone, which is why I'm definitely not going to mention it here.
Yes, do a quick search for exactly. Rick Ray on the search engine of your choice.
Luckily,
perhaps
before
you might
Google,
find.
I didn't exist. But no, there are actually in the US, there are reputational managers who will, you know, for a fee, who will go out there and get rid of incriminating evidence. and make sure that if someone, as lots of people do, an awful lot of companies before they interview someone will have a quick Google search, a box down a Google search to see what they've done, and they will make sure the positive stuff comes to the top. It's search engine optimization on a personal basis, and it's already happening, and I think it was only going to get more frequent.
That is a very, very interesting area that I certainly hope to cover in the future, it being my specialist subject. But also, we are hoping to have a special geolocation podcast coming up in the next couple of months. So stay tuned to Tech Weekly. You can read all the debate over Facebook places and privacy on guardian.co.uk. Keeping with privacy for a moment, Research in Motion, the Canadian company that produces the handheld BlackBerry device favored by both business people and now teenagers, I've discovered, is under threat from another country's government as the row over their encryption protocols continues to rise. The device, which is used primarily to send and receive emails, has been embroiled in a battle over their users' content. Concerned governments say it can be used to foment terrorism, for example, or at least distribute information that could have terrorist intent. RIM says, even if it is, that they protect their users' rights to privacy. Now, earlier this year, we reported on their battle with the United Arab Emirates, who have subsequently banned the device because RIM refused to decode their users' messages. Most recently, however, the Indian government has stepped into the ring and is similarly threatening to ban the device. Rick, what's the latest on this story?
The Indian government has given RIM and the mobile phone companies in India until August the 31st to come up with some sort of technological way around this particular issue. And we'll have to see whether they do or not. The operators themselves, the mobile phone companies over there, are saying, look, you know, it's not up to us. We work with RIM they have to work with RIM to actually allow their customers to use BlackBerry devices. There's a certain amount of RIM kit that has to go into your network to connect up with the RIM service. So they've said, look, it's not really our issue. You need to go and talk to RIM. Now, the conversations between the government and RIM have been went on all the way through the summer and are still going on now. So I'm afraid it's really one to sort of watch this space and see what happens on the 31st.
It is fascinating, though, how much they're being targeted. Why RIM in particular? Is it because their encryption is totally different from the other telephone operators?
Yeah, I mean, essentially it's because of the way that RIM was created. I mean, the company itself, the BlackBerry device itself, was created at a time when you couldn't squeeze anything down a mobile phone network. That they came along and said, we want people to be able to access email. They were taking as the sort of basis of their system, they were taking pager network or the way that pager networks had worked. And they said, okay, what we need to do is we need to have really good encryption technology, not so much to make things private, but to make sure we can squash an email as much as humanly possible. Very good compression technology in order to get these things bouncing up and down mobile phone networks. So rather than build their own network, their own mobile phone network, they said, okay, well, we'll have a system which, when you're in a mobile phone company, you've got the BlackBerry device at one end, which talks over your network to RIM's own servers. And because you've got this terrible, you know, client-server-side software system, you've got fantastic compression on the device and fantastic compression back in RIM's own network. And the mobile phone company's network itself is actually quite dumb. So all you've got is this signal that's travelled across, which is encrypted outside of the mobile phone company's own networks. So with iPhone and with Android devices and all these devices, it's a lot easier to get into that network because the mobile phone network itself is more intelligent than it is with RIM. The problem with RIM is that you have to go to Canada, actually, where the servers are, if you want to get in there, decrypt these messages. Now, there are ways around that system, which we have in the UK. The thing that we really have to remember here is that RIM is attempting to operate within the legal jurisdictions of different countries. So we might think that what the Saudis have done, what the UAE was doing, what India is now attempting to do is atrocious. But to get text message and other technically encrypted messages read out to you in this country, you just go to the court and then come up and produce your writ or whatever it is in order to get access to it. So we have in the UK ways in which the police and other security services can monitor telecoms, and what they're trying to do in India and Saudi Arabia and UAE is to have those sort of technologies or those kind of abilities themselves.
And of course, the fact that they're focusing on RIM suggests that any other device, whether it's an Android device or whether it's an iPhone device or whether it's another cellular device, that suggests that they already have pretty open access to those technologies.
They're much simpler to get access to. I should also make one other point, which is, this is not specifically about India, but this is certainly about the Gulf states, so Saudi and UAE, who were looking at this. The fact they were targeting BlackBerry was quite specific because, firstly, BlackBerry's are phenomenally successful in the UAE, but they're also used by the high net worth individuals. They are the big device. And it was very much a way of saying, yes, we can, you know, everyone can go out and have fun and all the rest of it. And we know some of you are probably drinking and who knows what else is going on, but we are keeping an eye on you. You might think you can do whatever you want. It's not so much about terrorism, it's more about society. Just another way of tapping people on the shoulder and saying, you know, be careful.
Charles, what are the financial implications for RIM if suddenly they're banned in all of these, as Rick was saying, you know, these are countries where the BlackBerry is very popular?
Well, in India, there's 800,000 BlackBerry users, which is not inconsiderable. So the knock-on effects would be very big for them. I mean, there's an interesting implication in what the Indian government is doing. They're saying that they want to be able to get at the BlackBerry messages because of terrorism, because it was all about the flowing out of the Mumbai terrorism event, because it was claimed that they were using BlackBerry or something like that to plan it. But the implication, therefore, is that the Indian government is able to get pretty much real-time access to the device stream of any other product out there. BlackBerry is the only one, because of the particular architecture it uses, where they can't do a real-time investigation of what's going on, which I think is rather intriguing, you know, as a thing to consider about what the Indian government is able to do. And if the Indian government is able to do it, well, then you know, you'd consider that possibly 3G as a method of encryption is not really that secure compared to what governments have.
Indeed, and this will seriously, I think, have financial implications for the company. Will they be able to survive the loss of the Indian, the Saudi, and the UAE markets globally?
Well, India is the second largest mobile phone market in the world after China. So, I mean, the fact that they're also going to have these issues in China, I would have thought at some point.
Well, you can read more about this story on guardian.co.uk. Finally, the British computer games industry was dealt a blow this week with the announcement that the Dundee-based development studio Real Time Worlds was going into administration. The company, which employed 150 people and was founded by Grand Theft Auto creator David Jones, was a central feature of the strong Dundee development scene. But its loss will certainly be felt around the UK's slowly dissolving games industry. Joining us on the line to discuss this closure and the future of the UK games development scene is Keith Stewart, who looks after the Guardian's games coverage. Welcome, Keith.
Hello, Alex.
Keith, what happened to Real Time Worlds?
Well, it looks like they have burnt up all the masses of investment that the company procured over the last sort of two or three years. It looks as though they took in around $100 million of venture capital investment. When the game was released last month, it wasn't doing the figures that they were expecting. They've just released some figures to say that the game has around 160,000 subscribers, which is reasonably good for a startup, massively multiplayer game. But APB to be profitable needed probably in the millions, considering that the game has been in development for 5 years with a staff that peaked at around 150 people.
Now, this is quite typical of the current game scene, isn't it, where development companies really need a massive hit. Not too dissimilar from the film industry that seeks really high box office earnings in the first weekend, is it?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we're looking at now the development costs have risen over the last sort of 3 or 4 years, especially with the current generation of consoles. They've risen incredibly. I mean, I think we're looking at maybe sort of between $30 and $50 million now for a AAA game, and that's usually with a staff of between 100 and 200 people. So, yeah, we're definitely looking at the kind of lower end of mainstream Hollywood movies, which is incredible. And this has been massively in the last sort of 3 or 4 years in the last generation of consoles.
What do you think has changed? I mean, it sounds as if this couldn't have been an unexpected outcome for Real Time Worlds if this was the only product that they were producing, given the absolute necessity of having a AAA hit.
Yeah, I think what's happened, and I've spoken to a couple of people at Real Time Worlds since they went down, from what they're saying, there's been a certain amount of hubris within the company. They have developed this game over 5 years. They've allowed the development to run over what it really should have to remain kind of profitable. Because the problem with massively multiplayer games is you need to build in about a year of kind of building up a subscriber base, and it just seems bizarre that they didn't factor this into the Excel spreadsheet of costs. And what I'm hearing from people from within the company is there was certainly a kind of an overconfidence, almost an arrogance around the company that everything was going to be okay, that, you know, this was going to be an enormous game, it was going to be an enormous hit. It was almost taken for granted, even though it seems that within the development team there were concerns about certain aspects of the game not working.
What will happen to the developers? What will happen to this 150 staff? Is there enough space within the UK games industry at the moment to pick these people up?
I think there is. In fact, almost immediately after the company went into administration last week, a recruiter in development set up a kind of almost a mini recruitment fair for those staff in a hotel in Dundee. And you got people going up from Sega and from Blitz Games and from other companies just whizzing up there to poach those staff, because they're actually an incredibly talented team, and I've been up there several times, and to get this game to work, it's so incredibly complex. And they're a very good team, and they're a very respected team. So I actually think that a lot of those staff will be able to find jobs in the UK development community, because all the studios that are working on games now, they are having to expand massively to cope with the demands of working on, you know, next-gen games, especially now that you don't just release a game these days and that's it. You have to follow up with downloadable content, with a really robust kind of online multiplayer gaming strategy as well. And this takes a lot of staff. And the one thing that Real Time World has got a lot of is software engineers that are used to providing DLC and providing really kind of robust online services. And they'll be very valuable.
What effect do you think this will have on the morale of the UK games industry, the closure of this development studio?
It's a really sad story. But I don't think it's going to be devastating, because APB was such a singular project, really. You know, a massively multiplayer game of this sort has never really been attempted before, and not a lot of people in the UK are kind of working on this sort of game. So I don't think it's going to send kind of massive fear tremors through the whole of the industry, but I think it's probably kind of sound a warning siren to people not to rely too heavily on masses and masses of investment, unless you have a kind of development structure in place where you understand where that money's going to run out.
Well, Keith, also in this week's games news is the controversy about the latest release of Medal of Honor. Defence Secretary Liam Fox called for the military shooter to be banned. What's the story here?
Well, Liam Fox, it seems, is reacting to some footage of the game that became available showing the multiplayer level, and it showed players playing as Taliban shooting allied forces. And he's reacted to that in an interview and said he thinks that's disgusting, and any game that appears to support the Taliban or show the Taliban defeating allied forces is reprehensible. In a personal statement, he's called for retailers to kind of boycott the game. And it's a sort of a bizarre move, really, considering that the Conservative Party, especially through Ed Vasey, the Culture Secretary, are really trying to show their allegiance with the games industry in the UK and really trying to show their support for games. And Ed Vasey's department have actually distanced themselves from Liam Fox's comments and said that's not kind of representative of the coalition's stance on games. And it does seem a rather anachronistic and kind of poorly targeted criticism of the game.
Well, how long do you think it will be before this kind of headline doesn't boil up in the press about the computer games industry? We haven't heard anything, for example, about more serial killers have occurred in the US since the TV series Dexter was launched on HBO. You know what I mean? I mean, how long before the games industry stops being the target of this kind of vitriol, do you think?
I think it's dying out. I really do. And I think this sort of thing is becoming more and more rare. And it's more and more to do with individuals that don't really understand games. And it's less to do with a kind of systemic hatred or suspicion of games. And I thought it was really telling, actually. The Daily Mail ran a story about it and talking about this game as being a Taliban game, which is kind of ridiculous and inaccurate. But there were no comments under it, and usually you'd expect an anti-video game story on the Daily Mail to attract hundreds of comments and people saying, ban this filth, but that's not happening now. I think it's slow, but it's already happening. But I think it's definitely a generational thing, and I think 5 or 10 years' time, no politician is going to want to stand up and say that they're anti-games, because we're all gamers now, you know, everyone plays games.
Indeed, I am still very keen to find evidence of both David Cameron and Nick Clegg as gamers in their youth, because then we will have won. Oh, yes, we will. Anyway, read up on all these stories as they unfold and more from the Guardian's technology team at guardian.co.uk/technology. The The issues surrounding the Research in Motion BlackBerry struggle do touch on our main feature this week, net neutrality. Campaigners describe it as the most important question of our age. He or she who controls the network controls which information gets to the people. Governments and corporations currently walk an uneasy line, keeping access as neutral as possible by ensuring that certain companies don't offer preferential services to people who can pay, for example, without coming to any official stipulations. But now an infamous deal brokered between search engine Google and U.S. mobile phone provider Verizon that we reported on a couple of weeks ago has caused people from all camps to demand more formal treaties. I spoke with Desiree Milosevic, advisor to the UN and board member of the Internet Society, about the current debate. She began by explaining why we should be paying attention.
What we are really looking at today when we talk about net neutrality are those consequences, economic, political, and societal, that will infringe some of the benefits that we see on the internet today.
Desiree Milosevic on net neutrality. So, Charles, what does net neutrality actually mean? Who are the major players that Desiree referred to?
What net neutrality means is treating every packet equally so that you don't favour a packet if it's coming from one network or if it's for a particular service, you don't favour it over another, and equally you don't suppress them. So if it's a BitTorrent packet, you don't slow it up as Comcast did in the States. It's all the big ISPs who are ranged against the big content producers and the big sort of content pipes, because Google isn't a content producer, but it is a sort of content pipe in the sense that it you know, has YouTube, for example, and of course its own search engine. So it wants people to be able to get YouTube without having to, in effect, pay any gatekeepers along the way, so that the people who want to look at YouTube stuff don't find that it's better on one network than another if both networks are rated at the same speed.
Now, Rick, how much power do the telecoms companies have over this, the mobile phone service providers?
Well, it depends on which country you're looking at. In the US, they have more, certainly have more power, because there are monopolies in particular areas. So, I mean, if you live in sort of the outskirts of a large urban area, you've probably got the choice of several mobile phone companies. But when it comes to your fixed line access, you've got one company, and you're pretty much stuffed. Now, in the UK, because we've had regulation which has broken up BT's monopoly on the local loop with the invention of BT Openreach, there's a lot more competition. So if one company in the UK says, actually, we're going to favour YouTube over something else, they will see their customers switch. So but in the States, it's a lot more difficult to move. Now, it's on the fixed line network, because that's really where we're going to be debating this for the next couple of years, and then we'll be moving onto mobile.
Here's Desiree on how this issue will boil up in the UK specifically.
In this country, we haven't had a debate on net neutrality, partially because of the successful unbundling of the loop when we talk about wireline services and landline services. We haven't even touched the discussion upon mobile network services, which in effect should not be governed by the private interest only, because there is a government who would allocate the spectrum, and this spectrum is certainly scarce.
Now, Charles, when will this issue actually be big in the UK?
That's an intriguing question, because given that BT, despite local loop unbundling, BT is still the monopoly provider, the issue becomes one more of which ISPs are involved in it. And we have such a diversity of ISPs because you have it split among four or three big ISPs.
There's four big ones, yeah.
You have lots of mobile phone operators as well. It's rather hard for any one of them to break away and say, well, we're going to make it. We're going to charge Google for doing it, because people will, as Rick says, they'll just move. They'll say, well, stuff you, then we're going to the other one. If anyone was to try to do that, or if they were all to jump, then you'd get a sort of race to the bottom where they all be trying to undercut each other. It's a bit like a sort of micropayment system. So it's one of those things where I don't think it will be that big in the UK. It sort of keeps not showing its head, if you see what I mean. Whereas in the US, the issue is bigger. And I think also that what's been happening with Google and Verizon is interesting, because it shows that wireless needs to be thought about as well. Google has been using this strange phrase all the way through this debate about the public internet, as though there was a sort of a different internet somewhere. And people have been saying, well, what's this public internet, and how is it different from any other internet?
But just on a couple of points, actually, one of the things that Desiree said in that little clip there, talking about spectrum, which obviously the governments have power over, and the mobile phone companies need it, obviously, to get all our phone calls and text messages over. Now, in the US, in the spectrum auctions, Google actually pushed for the mandating or for net neutrality to be introduced as actually a license condition that you'd have to allow for the mobile phone companies, you'd have to allow open access. That something like that could happen in the UK. We've got a load of spectrum auctions next year, the digital dividend, the bit that's left over from when we switch off analog TV, which gets sold next year and then is actually used from the end of 2012 onwards. So there is the possibility of having this debate in the wireless world by talking about the very slightly dull and technical world of spectrum. There's also, I wanted to pick up a point that there's a difference between the philosophy of net neutrality and actually the nuts and bolts on the ground. People tend to get access confused with everything else. I mean, we don't have equal access to the internet. I bizarrely live in London, but I have a dreadful broadband connection, which is 2 meg. I can spend money and get a Virgin Media connection for 50 megabits. So on the access end, it's always been different. The flip side of that is that we do, because we've got so much video washing around the web, we do need to spend a lot more money on our networks. Some of them are creaking. I would say bits of BT's network aren't particularly good, but the main amount of data that's carried across those networks isn't bringing any money to the people who built the pipes. Now, Eric Schmidt at Mobile World Congress in Barcelona earlier this year specifically said, when we asked him about net neutrality, that he doesn't care if fixed line ISP operators do deals with content companies in order to make sure that particular content gets through the network faster or gets a guaranteed level of service, as long as everyone has access to the same deal. So Google comes in and does a deal with Verizon, fine. Why, if someone else comes in, AOL, Yahoo, or whoever, comes along and says to Verizon, we want the same deal, and Verizon says, you can't have it. That's where we've really got a problem. And where I think this will come out in the UK, possibly later this year or next year, is with Sky. Sky is obviously a broadband provider. It's also a provider of television. Now, the obvious thing to do, certainly if News Corp buys out full ownership of BSkyB, which Rupert Murdoch wants to do, is if I'm a Sky broadband customer, I get Sky Sports News or Sky Sports whatever, and it's perfect and brilliant, and most importantly, better than the iPlayer. And so the worry would be that News Corp would start offering differentiated pricing and differentiated customer service for particular other parts of the News Corp empire. And I suspect that, actually, News Corp is where might rear its ugly head in the UK really quite quickly, especially because Sky is now fighting against BT Vision, which is a broadband-enabled service.
Now, this is an interesting area, which is the political element, because this brings in issues also of monopolies and the content. And Desiree has something to say about this as well.
It is a continuing responsibility for all of us to express our views of what is the vision that we have for the society. So I would encourage everyone to get involved. We can see that Barack Obama is already stepping a little bit back from his announced pro-net neutrality stance when he became a president.
Why?
I think we have to look at the whole financial situation in the US and see who is currently making contributions to the government and see whether anybody is able to make a new set of investments, and everybody is counting on the private sector to make a new round of public investment in infrastructure, whether it's mobile or whether it's a wide infrastructure for broadband.
Now, Charles, it really sounds like what Desiree is saying is that the net neutrality debate is moving towards the commercial. They seem to be getting the power because of the economic crisis. Are global leaders' hands being forced by the economic crisis to step back, to make favors and exceptions for companies who can provide access in this way?
It's always easier not to get involved with these sorts of things. And you know, net neutrality is often one of those sort of, you know, angels on the head of a pin thing, because as Rick points out, you know, it's a question of access. And actually, as people have pointed out on the technology blog, you know, if you have a mobile network, for example, you have to prioritize the voice over the data, the voice packets, because they're digitized. You have to prioritize the voice because people get really antsy if the voice quality is rubbish, whereas they don't notice too much if the data comes over a bit sort of bits and pieces. The idea that the network treats everything exactly equally isn't quite true anyway.
You're spot on there. I mean, and I would, this is a terrible, I'm going to get flamed for this left, right and centre, but
Fodder.
Thank you. that I would happily be with a broadband provider that provided me with really fast, really good iPlayer and was able to do that by cutting off some of the peer-to-peer traffic, because I don't nick stuff off the web. So I've never been using the peer-to-peer networks. But I really, really like the iPlayer. And I would pay money for that.
It's perhaps worth mentioning that this week Demon has started up a special service which it says is specifically for gamers, where it's going to be giving gamers an advantage. But certainly it'd be really interesting if an ISP started up and said, okay, we're going to block, you know, try to block BitTorrent traffic. That would be fascinating. Would they get more people on it? You know, when the Digital Economy Act and Ofcom figures out their quote act over that, will ISPs start setting up doing that? That would be really interesting.
And just to pick up on, again, to pick up on something that Desiree said in that clip, it's about money, ultimately. In the UK, we're not getting any government money to pay for the next generation superfast broadband networks. Obviously, Virgin Media is rolling their network out, but they're never going to reach the entire country. BT is rolling out their fibre network, but they're never going to reach the entire country. You've got this 40% of the country which is just not going to be reached. So more money has to come in from somewhere. It's not coming from the government, which it is doing in Australia and other areas. So there's a way of saying, okay, well, are there other ways we could finance this? Well, one of them is obviously to look at the bulk of the traffic going across your network, which is video, and is being provided by commercial companies. A lot of it is being provided by commercial companies. They've got money. And most importantly, they're already spending money, cashing their content close to the network. Akamai and these guys. The BBC pays a lot of money to cash stuff close to the network. So why don't we take that money away from these third parties who don't invest in infrastructure, in their own infrastructure, but aren't investing in the infrastructure that comes into my door, and give it to the likes of, you know, BT or Virgin Media or whoever through these deals, provided any content company that comes along and says, I want one of these deals, gets equal treatment, which is exactly what Eric Schmidt had said.
Well, you can find out more and get in on the debate at guardian.co.uk. That's it for another Tech Weekly podcast. If you'd like to know more about any of these stories, then do go to guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Many thanks to our studio guests, Rick Ray and Charles Arthur. Thanks as well to Keith Stewart, who joined us down the line. I'm Alex Krotowski. The producer this week was Ian Chambers. See you next Tuesday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.